Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Raymond Tunkakar, filling in this week for Reuben Stern. In the days following the Newtown tragedy, many of us are left wondering what can be done to prevent such a horrific act from occurring ever again. Across the country, more than 300 school districts, including Columbia Public Schools and the University of Missouri, have been training people on what to do if they ever found themselves in that situation. Today on Intersection, we'll talk about ways to stay safe and hear about how parents and educators can talk with children about these issues. Joining me in studio to help us run through these ideas is Michelle Baumstark. She's the Director of Community Relations for the Columbia Public School District. And joining us by phone either now or shortly is Greg Crane. He's the founder and president of Response Options. That company is responsible for developing the ALICE response method for school safety in the event of an attack. That course is taught in numerous schools and college campuses across the nation. And for you in our audience, if you're a parent, what concerns do you have? How have you talked with your child about this? Please share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email us at intersection@kbia.org. Or you can also join our online chat by visiting our kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. And please stay tuned for the second half of this our program, where we'll be discussing the Affordable Care Act and how it impacts you. So just to kick off the discussion, Michelle, thanks for joining our program today.
Yes, thank you for
Could
having
me.
Could
you just talk about the mood at Columbia Public Schools today?
You know, we're really trying to keep our students focused on the task at hand, which is learning in the classroom. We spent some time on Friday addressing this with our staff members as well as our administrators, sent home a letter to parents on Friday talking about how to talk to their students about what happened, signs and symptoms to look for should their child be emotionally stressed about the incident, and really trying to today just reassure our parents that we do have safety and security measures in place in Columbia Public Schools, and we're doing everything we can to try to make sure that our schools stay safe and secure.
And you had mentioned some of the warning signs. Could you perhaps walk me through what
Yeah, certainly. Students who maybe are having difficulty understanding the issue, asking a lot of questions, they may be having nightmares, trouble sleeping, acting out. So those are all things to look for. And then just trying to reassure their child, answer the questions that they may have about the incident. Just trying to focus on just answering the questions they ask. Children don't always need to know every detail about every situation that happens. And sometimes as adults, we forget that. And so just really focusing on what their emotional needs are.
And can you walk me through an example of how one might address this with a child?
Yeah, definitely. Depending on the age of the student, getting down on eye level with that child, reassuring them that they are safe, answering any questions that they may have, but only answering the questions that they ask, not necessarily providing a level of detail that maybe an adult or an older child might want to have or feel the need to have. Kids really just want to know that they're safe, and they trust adults to make sure that they're safe.
Okay. And well, so part of this conversation was also hoping to explore the ALICE method of mm-hmm. responding to a threat. How did Columbia Public Schools first become involved with that?
You know, I think ALICE is something that is not just in Columbia Public Schools. It's nationwide. And we are always reevaluating our safety and security plans in Columbia Public Schools and really found like maybe there was a better method for how we address active intruders inside of a building. And this seemed to be something that came forth as a really viable option for us. We are very fortunate in Columbia Public Schools that we have strong partnerships with law enforcement. We have a great relationship with the Boone County Sheriff's Department. We have a great relationship with the Columbia Police Department. And we are fortunate that we have many retired Columbia police officers who help us with our safety and security plans. And in this case, several of our retired officers who work directly with Columbia Public Schools on their safety and security plans brought this method forth as something that we should be looking at and implementing in Columbia Public Schools.
Okay. And around what year was that?
This is actually the first full year that we've been fully implemented at our secondary levels.
Okay. Well, I want to bring Greg Curtis on the show right now. He's the founder and president of Response Options. That's the organization that actually came up with the ALIS method. Greg, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thanks for joining our show today, Greg. Can you just walk me through what the ALIS method actually is? What does it stand for, just to start off?
Well, ALICE is an acronym, stands for Alert, Lockdown, Inform, Counter, and Evacuate. And the concept is to, you know, try to provide people with as much information, you know, both before and during an event, and then having pre-planned and pre-equipped them with strategies and options that they can use to make a determination as to what type of response is in their best interest. And in reviewing the Columbine tragedy many years ago, you know, it was our thoughts that having a pre-planned, canned type response, if you will, just proves to be so inadequate so many of the times when our schools and whatever demographic actually fall under attack. And so we couldn't find a program that we thought, you know, we wanted to implement locally. So we developed one out of a need, and then, you know, that was 12 years ago, and now that development has grown quite substantially.
And I'm sorry, so you said it kind of came out of the Columbine attacks?
Well, we looked at, in, you know, how did Columbine, how is that going to affect us locally in our plans? You know, as a SWAT officer, we were training really, really hard to be the ones to respond and basically help, you know, save the day. But Columbine was our wake-up call and said, guys, you're not going to be able to get there in time. So if our thoughts were, well, if we can't get there in time to help everybody, how have we positioned them maybe to help themselves? And when we started researching what all the schools around the country were doing, which was either nothing at that time, we're talking 1999, or they had a lockdown plan in place. But, you know, you look at the Columbine tragedy 14 years ago now almost, and what we should have learned, you know, the kids who were impacted in that library, 54 of them, they sat there for 5 minutes until Harrison Klebold entered that library. Well, the question I had, especially since they had a way to get out of that library and exit the building, why did they stay there? Well, they stayed there because a procedure taught their teacher and them that you stay there. You don't take advantage of even a way to get away from danger. And, you know, it's almost unexcusable and unexplainable how we in public safety allowed program like that to become a national standard. But in reality, our focus in law enforcement was what we were going to do, not so much what the citizens who are actually under attack were going to do. And once we looked at it through the perspective of the victims, we realized, you know, this response is inadequate. They need more information. It needs to be an options-based protocol and empower the people to make a decision. If you find yourself in a situation of danger, what can you do? And not a sense of what you must do. What can you do to mitigate and assist you in surviving this situation?
Well, I want to remind listeners that this is Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar, filling in this week for Reuben Stern. On today's show, we're talking about school safety and airing our concerns following this weekend's tragic news from Newtown, Connecticut. Joining me in studio is Michelle Baumstark. She's the Director of Community Relations for the Columbia Public School District. And joining me by phone is Greg Crane, excuse me, I think I might have referred to you as Greg Curtis earlier, founder and president of Response.
I've been called worse, trust me.
He's the founder and president of Response Options. That company is responsible for developing the ALIS method of response in campuses and schools. And for those in our audience, have you taken an ALIS training course or one similar to it? What did you make of it? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Also, please remember that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2, online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. Michelle, I just want to ask you, so how did CPS – you kind of talked about how you know, you were working with law enforcement and they recommended the ALICE system. Could you just tell me about those talks? I mean, who introduced it first and at what point did you go through – did you try to vet other training options as well?
Well, you know, a lot of schools have their standard protocols and procedures in place that they use for all different types of emergency preparations. For example, you have your fire drills, your tornado drills, your earthquake drills, and you have your lockdown drills. And in this case, it's becoming more and more necessary that you are also prepared for active intruders. And so that's what ALICE prepares us for. And it's a different way of looking at the lockdown method, just like you know, we were talking about earlier. And we really felt like we don't want our kids to be sitting ducks. We want them to be able to contextually make decisions that will help them be able to save their own lives or get themselves out of a dangerous situation. Now, we are focusing really on our secondary students at this point in time just because they have more cognitive ability to make some of those decision-making things within context. Should I run? Do I need to, you know, do something to avert the danger? Those types of things. Whereas at the elementary level, it looks a little bit different. But we really felt like, you know, if law enforcement is telling us that we need to have a different strategy for our current lockdown system, you know, where you, or typically what you think about when you think about a lockdown is you lock your door and everybody gets underneath their desks. Well, that simply can't be the way that we continue to look at safety and security within our buildings, especially when you think about what, you know, happens when you have an active intruder in the building and it is unpredictable and you have to make quick decisions. And if there's an opportunity to escape and to run, that's what we want our kids to do, to get themselves out of immediate danger. And so that's the premise for trying to move forward with this. And, you know, our law enforcement officials are telling us as they look at, you know, all of the tragic situations that happen when you see school shootings or campus shootings or shootings anywhere within, you know, a confined facility, you know, it's a dangerous situation. We want our kids to be able to, if they have an opportunity to escape.
Okay. And so you had mentioned lockdown earlier. That's the traditional method of responding to that, to it.
Right.
A threat. Can you just walk me through that? And at what point did – I guess where did – when did that theory of response kind of emerge? Or maybe that's a question for Greg, actually.
Well, the concept of lockdown has been around for a very long time and originated in our prison systems. You know, the thought of forcing people to secure in place is a necessity in the prisons because obviously – we're not going to open the doors and give them the opportunity to leave the dangerous situation. So the best thing we can do for them is try to get them in cells and lock them down and hopefully keep them separated from, you know, whatever the danger is that's inside the facility. The major difference between prisons and our and any other demographic in our facilities in our community are obviously the people aren't necessarily confined to that facility. You know, for years, you know, in the initial phases of this program, I had to contemplate a very basic question. If we have a natural killer in the building of a fire, our primary response is to get out. If we have the human killer in the building of a shooter, our primary protocol now is to stay in. Why does that fundamental difference exist? I could not make a logical reason to have totally opposite baseline responses to very similar deadly dangers. And when you look at the fact that 98% of these shootings have been perpetrated by a lone individual, well, he can't be inside and outside at the same time. So if the shooter's inside, you know, you have a 98% chance he's a lone gunman. Get away from him. You'll always be safer.
Michelle, are there other tactics that the Columbia Public School District kind of employs to emphasize safety? I'm thinking maybe school resource officers or mm-hmm. substations?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have tried to be very proactive about safety and security in Columbia Public Schools. And even as recently as a week ago on Monday, just had an update on the safety and security improvements that we're planning on making in Columbia Public Schools. And at that time, we were talking about improving not only what we have as far as equipment with our buzz-in systems, our video intercom systems, are improving our radio systems that we currently have in place by replacing some of those, improving lighting. We also have added a police substation to Jefferson Junior High School. It'll be a pilot this year, and if it goes well, ideally we would like to be able to add additional substations to other buildings throughout the community. We currently have SROs in four of our buildings at the secondary level. Those are school resource officers. They are actual police officers. And so they provide an added level of security and protection for us within our secondary buildings. We would love to be able to have more of those. You know, that's a joint venture with Columbia Police Department and Columbia Public Schools. It does come with a cost. I mean, you're talking about employing a person, and so we have to work that out with Columbia Police Department. But hopefully by adding substations, we'll be able to come to some sort of compromise between having an SRO and having a police substation that maybe could fill a need that we can't necessarily fill with full-time personnel.
Okay. And at school, so in school districts across the nation, are those types of, are SROs and substations kind of normal practice, or is this something that Columbia is kind of on the vanguard
of? I think
of?
School resource officers are pretty pretty widespread throughout the country. It's certainly something that we're fortunate that we have a good relationship with our police department, and they're willing to commit staff to be a part of that program. We would love to have more. I think for any district across the country, you know, involves a financial commitment and a space commitment, but we really feel it's important for the safety of our buildings to have that police presence in and around our school buildings.
Okay. And just to go back to the ALFS method, how has that been received by parents?
You know, I think initially, just like with anything new, it's slightly controversial because it is a shift from what we have all been trained and conditioned to do, which is, you know, to lock the door and to find a place to hide within the classroom. And so that it's a shift because you're putting power and decision-making skills in the hands of not only the teacher in the classroom, but also the students to be able to make decisions about what is the best thing for me to do now. Do I find a escape route, or do I interact with the attacker? So that's a shift, and I think sometimes that's a little bit difficult for parents. I think it's more concerning for our elementary-level parents than it is for our secondary-level parents. There were just a lot of questions when we first started this, and I think parents are becoming more and more comfortable with it. And I think as we continue to implement, hopefully a lot of those questions will be answered, and parents will understand why we want to be able to give kids options when they're faced with a dangerous situation.
Okay. Greg, is that consistent with what you've been saying as well?
Yeah, it's very consistent. I think Michelle stated, you know, the way it goes very, very accurately. You know, there's always concern, especially amongst the younger ones. But, you know, what we find that many of the school districts we work with, a lot of them even down into their pre-K programs, they have an element of stranger danger training that goes on. And, you know, that training is to give in age-appropriate formats information to very young children. You know, how can they actually help themselves survive a situation or a counter with a predator trying to snatch him up. And, you know, all we're saying is, well, we need to have that same, you know, age-appropriate, realistic conversation with even little ones about the danger that may happen inside the building and not outside the building. And when you look at the example of what some of the kids, just incredible things that they did in Sandy Hook last week, and you had six-year-old kids coming up with action, proactive action on their own. I mean, it's just incredible so many people in our communities are capable of. But again, are we enhancing their capability through knowledge and through a little bit of training? And are we cultivating it in the masses to as many people as possible? Or are we just hoping that there will be someone who can just be a natural born leader, think outside the box, think beyond the standard lockdown protocol and come up with a different plan because that one doesn't match our needs right now? I think it's doing our citizens a disservice if we are giving them a single option to a very dynamic, very stressful, very unique situation. And I can't applaud Michelle and Columbia PD and Boone County SO, who I've had the pleasure of training folks from all those organizations, you know, in their efforts. And I will say, as far as the SROs around the country goes, you know, for your listeners, there is currently an effort in Congress because of the schools to prison pipeline controversy that's being raised in some areas of the country to do away with police in schools, and so, or do away with a lot of the funding for police in schools. And I would just say that, you know, because of, you know, Michelle's statements and the experience that she's had, that that's a incredibly stupid thing to be done, if you ask me. And I would encourage your listeners to be sure that their personnel in Congress are aware of you want to continue those funds and then that those operations.
Well, there's kind of a lot to unpack there, but I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about safety at schools and on campuses. Joining me in studio is Michelle Baumstark, a spokesperson with the Columbia Public School District. And joining me by phone is Greg Crane, founder and president of Response Options. And if you're a parent in our audience, how are you talking to your kids about safety? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Please give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection at kbia.org. Greg, earlier you mentioned, adapting the ALICE program that's age appropriate for elementary school students. What does the ALICE method, I suppose, what does it look like for elementary aged children?
Well, it predominantly looks like, you know, follow the lead of the teacher. But when teachers are, you know, incapacitated for whatever reason, we do provide little ones through some role playing and some game playing, you know, lessons that again create those mental tools that they can reach to. You know, for instance, you know, playing games like Ants on the Hill or something that requires them to move fast and move around and they're trying to escape. You know, again, you know, I hate to sound callous, but shooting people and killing them is actually a very difficult skill. But the problem is too many times when these lunatics go into our, especially our schools, into buildings around the country, they find very soft, very easy targets. And, you know, when people are killed sitting in a corner, I always wonder, you know, you have to wonder, back to Columbine, you know, every child that was in the library that was shot sitting down. Why were they all sitting down? Because they were doing what they were told to do. So, again, with the little ones, we give them some game, give them some role playing that creates the mindset and muscle memory of if someone is trying to hurt me, I need to move. I need to try to get away. I need to try to get out. And if we do get out, where do they go? Our elementary teachers, one time a year, they had a walking field trip where they took the children to where the rally point was, the reunification point. So if they got separated from a teacher, they still knew where they were going to go. We saw that this weekend or Friday when many of the students who, without their teacher, for unfortunate reasons, got out of the building by themselves, well, they were found wandering in the streets, and a neighbor had to take them up and take them to the police station. We want those kids to know if you get out of this building, there is a rally point. Just like parents teach their children, if the house is on fire and we got to get out of the house, and this is where we will all meet up. It's just fundamental safety protocols and procedures that we have in place typically for other types of dangers. Well, we may need to use some of those protocols like evacuation, like reunification for this danger as well.
Michelle, what schools is the ALICE program actually taught in?
Well, we have it fully implemented in all of our secondary buildings, which includes our middle schools, our junior high schools, and our high schools. We have trained all of our administrators at both the secondary level and the elementary level, and then we're working on a level of implementation at our elementary schools.
Okay. And, Greg, how is it looking across the country? Are more and more schools buying into this, or is there some hesitance? Or
The pendulum is swinging so fast, it's sometimes overwhelming. I tell folks kind of jokingly, 10 years ago I was thrown out of many places. Nowadays we're invited to so many places. It's quite a movement towards proactive response. But if you look at even some of the, you know, very prestigious governmental agencies out now in the discussion that's being had and some of the recommendations that are coming out and the videos that are coming out, you know, the city of Houston with Department of Homeland Security assistance just released a video called Run, Hide, and Fight. Now, years ago, if I had used the word fight in any kind of acronym involving violent intruder defense, I mean, that would have been a no-go from the start. But as unfortunately as we see more and more of these events in more and more different types of venue, more and more people are asking the question, you know, when then? What do I do when a bad guy comes into my building and then I'm facing a determined killer? What do I do? Sitting in the corner, sitting under the table, just isn't going to work for me then, and I don't have answers to that question. And it's just not fair for people to have to try to come up with an answer to that question in the heat of the moment. So, again, we built the program to be very simple, and it's very simple by design, because in moments of stress, duress, and danger, to try to come up with complicated tasks and fine motor skills, that's not going to happen. You know, we want people to engage in very simple strategies, but they're effective strategies. They're things that we know through some of the circumstances that we went through in our careers that you can survive being shot at. Well, and what is it that you can do to impact his ability to shoot you accurately? Because that's what gets people hurt. Now, I tell folks quite often that, you know, if someone's shooting a 9mm at me, I only have to be out of the way by 10mm. That's not much. But standing still just doesn't create the obstacles, if you will, to shooting accurately. So we gave them the basic concepts of noise, movement, and distractions, and how that impacts that skill set.
Okay. Well, Greg, earlier you alluded to some early skepticism among some schools. Michelle, maybe walk me through this. So why would there have been early skepticism? Why aren't more schools – I guess why are some schools reluctant to kind of pick this on?
Some of it is – well, there's a couple reasons, I think. One is a level of understanding about what it is that we're trying to teach kids to do. I think another is the level of responsibility that we feel like we're entrusting into kids, giving them essentially decision-making skills when it comes to making life or death decisions in some cases. And so that's a scary thing to think about, but that's the reality of where we are today, that we do need to give our kids the ability to be able to make decisions and to protect themselves as best they can when they're in a environment like this. And so I think those are two reasons. I think parents being scared is another reason. And, you know, we all are, but we also want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to give our kids the skills and the tools that they need to keep themselves safe should something like this ever happen.
Okay. And we only have about a minute left in this first half of the program, but in that remaining time, could you just talk about any changes that the Columbia Public School District might do to kind of beef up security or respond to the tragic events of Friday afternoon?
Yeah, we're going to continue with the implementation of our safety and security plans that we have in place. The Board of Education talked on Monday about where we were headed. We're going to continue to install the buzzer systems in the remaining school buildings that need the buzzer systems installed. We're going to continue to look at improvements that need to be made, lighting, look at how our pilot program goes with our police substation, and continue to do everything we need to do to make our schools safe.
Okay, and if parents want to look at some resources on how to cope with this or talk to their kids, where can they go?
Certainly, they can talk to their school counselor, their teacher, their school administrator. We sent a letter home on Friday with some tips for parents, but definitely encouraging them to talk to anyone at their school building.
Okay, and just briefly, what were some of those tips?
Just to comfort their child, allow their child to ask questions, and to make sure that they're addressing their emotional needs, giving them the time they need to adjust.
Okay. And Greg, just the remaining seconds of the first half, what are your plans for the Alice method?
Our plans is to do what we've been doing now, you know, every day for 12 years, and that's just to continue to deliver the message that a one-size-fits-all strategy is inadequate. We have to empower folks who come under attack. You know, God bless them that they're going to have to perhaps do something for themselves, and how have we equipped them to do that?
Okay, and we'll have to end that the first half of the conversation there. This is Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On today's show, we've been discussing safety in schools, on college campuses, and in schools. I've been joined today in studio by Michelle Baumstark. She's with the Columbia Public School District, and joining us by phone was Greg Curtis, founder and president of Response Options. Michelle and Greg, thank you for joining our show. Next, how are you going to be affected by the Affordable Care Act? Please stay tuned to the second half of our program where we'll discuss that. And we'll return after a very short break. discussing some of the changes in Missouri. And this is Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar, filling in this week for Ruben Stern. According to a recent poll, the number of Missourians opposing the Affordable Care Act has dropped in the last 2 years. So more people are for it, but how many actually understand it? Many of us might not actually know what's in the nearly 1,000-page document. Today on Intersection, we'll make sense of the federal healthcare law and help explain how it'll impact you. Joining me in studio to help us parse through the healthcare legislation is Thomas McAuliffe. He is a policy analyst for the Missouri Foundation for Health. Thank you, Thomas. Also joining us in studio is Dr. Andrew Quint. He's a physician and the medical director for Columbia's Family Health Center. Thank you, Andrew. And joining us by phone is Mary Timmel. She's the outreach manager at Small Business Majority. That's a nonprofit that represents small businesses. And for you in our audience, what questions do you have about the Affordable Care Act? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Well, to kick off this conversation, I just want to find out what changes have actually taken place in Missouri since the Affordable Care Act was first implemented. You want to take that, Thomas?
Sure, I would love to. Thanks for having the Missouri Foundation for Health on.
That's our pleasure.
What has happened or what's been implemented? I mean, when you think about this law is implemented between 2010 and 2020. So this is 10 years of things that get kicked in. But probably most important, $62 million returned back to Missouri this year because of what's called the medical loss ratio.
And what is that?
That is a provision in the law, otherwise known as the MLR, in which it says that the insurance companies must spend between 80 and 85% of all the money they take in on actual care. And anything that exceeds that amount needs to be returned in the form of a rebate. Now, many of your listeners probably pay something towards their insurance, but the law says that the check must go back to the person who paid for the insurance, the majority of the insurance, and that it can be actually be held until the next year to be offset for the cost of insurance. So if you have a listener who says, hey, I paid for my insurance and I didn't get any money back, well, there's a chance either your insurance company didn't exceed that 80% or it went to your employer who's holding it and can by law hold it until next year to offset any increases in insurance costs.
Okay. I'm not sure if you have the numbers on this, but what percentage of insurance companies abided by that ratio?
100% abided by it. How many returned in rebates? That's by a state-by-state kind of case, and I do not have the actual compliance numbers off the top of my head. I do know it's $62 million came back. Actually, the insurance companies had written the checks, and they waited until the Supreme Court had ruled. And almost a week after, which was earlier than they needed to, they actually sent out the checks. Another component that's been instituted is no children can be denied on the basis of pre-existing condition. Children can stay on their parents' insurance until the age of 26, which I might note is the most popular component of the law right now. The donut hole, that is a component in which seniors would have to pay for a certain percentage of their pharmaceuticals, a very large portion of that, that is slowly over time being closed. It used to be that once seniors ran up to a certain dollar amount, they had to pay 100% of their pharmaceuticals until about $6,000 of output, and then a catastrophic plan would kick in. That, about $3,000 to $4,000, often impoverished up to 10 million seniors and cause them either to not take their drugs or to go off the drugs altogether. That's being closed most dramatically next year, but that is the second most popular component of the law. And I think the third thing that is really kind of kicking in, and we'll see it a lot, we've seen a little of it, we're going to see a lot of it next year, is this whole question of the insurance exchanges, those marketplaces where you can purchase insurance.
And just for listeners that that might not know about that, it's been likened to – it's like an online marketplace likened to Travelocity for insurance.
Absolutely. It'll be a web page that you'll be able to go to, and you will be able to compare insurance prices, insurance packages. And in fact, you will even probably be able to go to a second page and be able to tailor an insurance package according to your own needs. in Massachusetts, actually, they have a very robust individual market now. Prior to the passage, they passed a similar law to the United States, to the Affordable Care Act. Their individual market was complete. It was like ours now, very there were slim pickings, to put it kind of mildly. But after the passage of the law, because they were able to sell a number of set packages, they can now get very creative. So I could see in 2014 actually a robust individual market where people could buy all sorts of insurance packages tailored to their specific health needs.
Andrew, I want to bring you into this conversation. How have medical health providers been affected by this?
So far, I would guess, and thanks also for having me on the program. So far, the main effect has been on quality improvement programs, I would say. There's seed money through the Affordable Care Act to help try to change the way we deliver care because everybody recognizes that if everybody has health insurance but we don't do anything about the cost of health care, then it would be unaffordable. So the Affordable Care Act recognizes that and provides seed money for essentially experimentation on better delivery models. And so we've got several projects going. And, you know, I don't actually know precisely where all the money comes from for these things, but most of it originates from the Affordable Care Act. Utilizing care managers, trying to organize healthcare better, trying to provide more individual attention to patients with chronic disease, trying to make sure that they're taking their medications when they're supposed to, tracking people who are going to the emergency room or being hospitalized and trying to follow up with them to figure out, you know, where was the breakdown that they ended up having to go to the emergency room or get hospitalized and could we have done something to intervene. Just a whole variety of projects. So we're at the Family Health Center. We're very busy with a couple of these projects. And to me, that's been the biggest impact so far, other than personally that my two oldest kids are still on my insurance plan, who are in college now, so that's been good for me.
Okay, and Mary Timmel, are you there?
I am.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining our show today. Well, I just want to ask you, how have small businesses been affected by this?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the biggest portions of the Affordable Care Act that we try to educate small businesses on is the tax credit. There's a tax credit for small businesses. It's up to 35% of the premium expense. It's businesses with fewer than 25 full-time employees with average annual wages less than $50,000 per year, where the employer has been paying at least 50% of the premium cost. Now, that's 91.8% of all Missouri businesses are eligible for some portion of this credit. So we really try to get that information out there to let the folks know who have been able to provide insurance for their employees that there is a tax credit in there for them.
Okay, and I thought it might be helpful to our listeners to kind of talk about different groups and see how they might be affected by this. So earlier, Thomas, you had mentioned that young people under the age of 26 are now covered under they are eligible to be covered under their insurance or their parents' insurance plans. What about young people that say, I don't know, if their parents are unemployed or self-employed and don't have access to that?
So right now, those kids are or young adults are in. They typify the problem with the American insurance system right now. They, you know, we get phone calls from people like this all the time. Well, what can I do? And the first thing you have to say is, do you have a pre-existing condition? And most of them say, well, no, I don't have heart disease or I don't have cancer. And you say, well, have you had acne? Do you have asthma? Because that's a pre-existing condition. You call up an insurer, and the insurer is going to put you into a higher rate or tell you that you're uninsurable. Chances are, however, that you know, if you're in your 20s, you're in what's called the indestructible phase, and that is you're relatively healthy. You think you don't need insurance, and you actually are a moneymaker for insurance companies. For those individuals, they can call up and get a catastrophic plan that covers most of their needs. But it's better to think about 2014. what happens in 2014? In 2014, you graduate from college. You're no longer on your parents' insurance. Let's say you have a job that doesn't offer insurance. That's key here, because if you have a job that has that does offer insurance, you can't stay on your parents' plan, and or you can't go to one of these exchanges. So 2014, you get a job, doesn't have insurance. You may qualify for a subsidy from the federal government to purchase insurance. You go to the exchange and you purchase your own insurance. You essentially become your own HR manager. Now, when we think about this, tomorrow at work I have my insurance orientation. We have it every year, and it's confusing. It's difficult to understand what's in network, what's out of network. Well, that's what these exchanges are meant to be. If you go to this website, it's supposed to be quote-unquote reasonable. You should know what your insurance covers, how much you have to pay, what is covered on a certain tier, what is not covered on another tier. So starting in 2014, most of the individuals that you're describing will either get help in purchasing insurance, employed or not employed, will be able to possibly qualify for Medicaid, employed or unemployed, and will be able to be kind of in charge of their own insurance, purchasing what it covers or what it may not cover. So there's a whole there's a host of opportunities starting in 2014 for the population you're speaking of.
Okay, and you mentioned the federal subsidy. That's on a sliding scale based on income, correct?
It is. It's from 133% of poverty to 400% of poverty. What does 400% of poverty? That's about $88,000 for a family of four. So it ranges from, and obviously at the far end of the scale, if you're 133% of poverty, your subsidies are going to be much higher. The subsidy will pay up to 98% of the cost of your insurance. You would be responsible for 2%. And at 400% of poverty, that scale looks at you paying about 10% of the cost of the insurance, depending on what the price is. So there's a lot of opportunity to actually purchase insurance and be kind of incentivized to do so. I mean, when we talk about this, most Americans want to purchase insurance. Because let's think about this. You purchase car insurance and you hope you never get in a wreck. You purchase health insurance and you almost always intend to use it. Because we're going to have a checkup. Something is going to happen throughout the year that you're most likely going to go to a physician or enter the healthcare system. So if people can purchase insurance, they will. The key is incentivizing it so that they do. And these exchanges and these subsidies are meant to say it's easy to purchase insurance, and this is what you need to do, and this is where you can go to do it.
Okay, well, let's just bring Medicaid into this.
No, I'm just joking. This is a big political debate that's going to happen.
Well, the idea was to change the requirements for Medicaid so people that made upwards of or below 133% of the poverty line would be covered. What happens if and right now Missouri is going through it's just debating whether or not they should expand Medicaid. What happens if that expansion doesn't take place? And currently, who's covered under Medicaid also? What percentage of the poverty level?
That's interesting. So if you're children, it's up to 300% of poverty. If you have children, it's up to 19% of poverty. That's $3,600 a year. If you have no children, you cannot get Medicaid in this state. So really, we're talking about low-income families, and we're talking about individuals with children or children themselves. So let's say that the population you're speaking to, you graduate college and you can't find a job and you're living at home, like many of us have been, you can't get Medicaid. You cannot get Medicaid in our state. So the idea was that because this population is not what, you might say that the insurance companies aren't dying to sell insurance to low-income or unemployed, the idea was this law upped Medicaid up to 133% of the poverty, just to those populations that would not likely be sold insurance even with an exchange. And the idea was that you could get the working poor. Now, let's get it. 80% of the uninsured are working poor. Either they have a full-time job or a family member has a full-time job. So we're not talking about quote-unquote deadbeats. We're talking about people who are working full-time jobs and work at places that pay too low or don't offer insurance or both. This law was to help those individuals. Now, most of us never predicted that the Supreme Court was going to allow states to decide whether to accept the Medicaid expansion or not. The majority said that this was a new program. It was as interesting because it's the Medicaid program, and it's been around for a very long time, but they said this was a new component of the law or new program and that each state could decide. Now, here's the deal, that if our state decides not to expand Medicaid, an interesting thing, and you set it up well, this gives subsidies to people between 100 and 400% of poverty. But below 100% of poverty, there are no subsidies. There is no remedy. So if the Affordable Care Act is continued to be implemented and the state of Missouri decides not to expand the Medicaid program, those who are most vulnerable will be immune, will not have to purchase insurance. They will not have to follow the individual mandate, but they will get no help purchasing insurance. And when we think about Missouri, that means rural Missouri. Rural Missourians disproportionately receive or are in health profession shortage areas and will not get this assistance. And I would say that as you start thinking about this, how do rural providers and rural hospitals keep functioning when those most vulnerable populations that they serve will not have insurance? It's a big problem.
And I do want to explore the rural angle to it. But before we get to that, I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Raymond Tungekar, filling in for Ruben Stern. On today's show, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. And our guests in the studio today are Thomas McAuliffe, a policy analyst for the Missouri Foundation for Health, and Dr. Andrew Quint, the medical director for Columbia's Family Health Center. And joining us by phone is Mary Timmel. She's the outreach manager for the Small Business Majority. And for you in our audience, will the Affordable Care Act change the way you seek out medical care? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Dr. Quint, so how is this going to play out in rural areas? We've been reading for a while about rural doctor shortages. Are they kind of equipped to kind of handle this new influx of newly insured people?
So I'm not sure I can speak to the rural side so much since I work here in Columbia. I do want to tack on that another component of this is that hospitals receive funds called DSH funds.
And what is that?
Disproportionate share hospital funds. It comes through the federal government, from the federal government through the states, and is to pay for uncompensated care. So right now, all the hospitals can apply for DSH funds when they get patients who come in who need emergent care that they're not allowed to turn away. Obviously, they shouldn't anyways, but they can't turn it away. Say someone uninsured coming to the emergency room or being hospitalized, and they can get some compensation for that uncompensated care through the DSH funds. So the assumption was that the DSH funds would not be necessary with the Affordable Care Act because everybody would have, or almost everybody would have, insurance. And again, the people who put this together didn't anticipate that states would turn down Medicaid expansion. So if Missouri turns down Medicaid expansion, that group of people who are under 100%, not only won't they get Medicaid and they won't have insurance through the Affordable Care Act, they will remain uninsured. Most of them are uninsured now anyways. But now when they go to the hospitals, any of the hospitals won't have the DSH funds available to make up for that uncompensated care. So I see it as a real disaster for the hospitals, both not just the rural hospitals, all of the hospitals that provide uncompensated care.
And are there any other grants or programs under the Affordable Care Act that could be used to kind of supplement that funding?
No, not at all.
So rural hospitals get funds, strategic funds, and they have for a number of years to be a certain kind of hospitals. And to add to the woe, those strategic funds are disappearing in the next 2 years. So those are the kind of monies that they might have used to be a little more adaptive to the kind of changes that Andrew's speaking of.
So, we're a community health center, so we see people without insurance already. And so this group of people we're talking about, under 100%, they're already not insured. So from that standpoint, that's not really changed for us. We have clinic sites in Salisbury and Marceline, which are rural, And again, the percentage of uninsured coming to those clinics probably won't change. To me, this is the biggest effect of this is the when people in that category need specialty care or hospital care, and they will have less access to that than they do now.
Mm. Mary Timmel, I just want to bring you back into this conversation. Earlier you talked about tax credits that would be available to small business owners. Are there other subsidies that small business owners could take advantage of to kind of compensate for the new expense of having to insure their employees?
Well, sure, and we like to stress that 96% of all businesses will not be they will not have an obligation to insure their employees. I know that's one of the big myths out there, but the shared responsibility requirement is only for businesses with 50 full-time employees or more. So that's one of the things we like to make sure that the smallest of the small business owners know. And we're also just looking forward to the implementation of the exchanges. That ability for the resources is going to be a huge difference maker for small business owners and small business insurance shopping.
Okay, and earlier you just mentioned that the mandate to employ. To purchase health insurance for your employees only applies to small businesses with 50 or less employees.
50 or more.
Is there a chance that small businesses might actually limit their employee pool as a result of that?
We don't really like to think about it in that way. I mean, we've all heard stories on the news about larger businesses discussing that. Small business owners, they're currently just worried about insurance for folks that they have. A lot of small business owners want to be able to insure their employees. Just cost is their biggest obstacle to overcome. So, again, 96% are businesses with 50 or less. So it won't affect them. And what we look at is how to make it affordable for the smallest of the small businesses, 25 and under, 10 and under. And those are the folks that are really struggling that have really seen their premiums skyrocket in the past.
Okay. And Dr. Quinn, I just want to go back to the idea of DSH funds. So let's say states were to expand Medicaid and DSH funds were no longer necessary. Are there still patients that take advantage of emergency care that are not really – that are kind of left out of this safety net that might not be covered by Medicaid or –
I think there's still going to be people who are – who don't qualify for Medicaid, whether expansion occurs or not. I'm sure there'll be a group of people who qualify for Medicaid or don't qualify for Medicaid, but choose not to purchase through the health insurance exchanges. I mean, I think everybody's predicting that there'll still be some people like that. I don't know that you might know more about this than I do. If there's a defined group that we can identify.
There isn't a defined group, but you're absolutely correct. Because they didn't change the laws that said that emergency rooms can turn people away, and we had a president and a presidential candidate telling us we do have socialist health care. It's called the emergency room.
Yeah.
These individuals are still going to show up in emergency rooms. They still cannot be turned away. But here's the problem. Currently, DSH payment pays some of them, but not a great deal. Most of this cost is pushed on to people who have private insurance. It's called cost shifting. It's essentially fraud. So fraud, and I know that some of your listeners are like, oh, my God, fraud. But essentially, private insurance is defrauded out of extra money to pay for the uninsured. The problem is now everyone's supposed to have insurance and DSH payments are supposed to go away and cost shifting is supposed to go away, but people are still going to show up at the emergency room.
Yeah. So realistically, who's going to absorb those costs?
I'm thinking the hospitals are going to get stuck with it and then maybe try to pass it on by somehow getting the state to give them some more money for it. I don't know really.
They're going to pass it on to private insurance still. But the second fastest growing sector of personal debt is medical debt. Number one, just FYI, is student debt. So if you go to a hospital, have you ever gone to a hotel room and close the door and you look on the back of the door and there's the price of the hotel room? And you got this off of Travelocity for $50 and on the back of it says $350. That's called the rack rate. No one pays the rack rate unless you're uninsured.
Yeah.
You show up at the hospital and you pay the rack rate for an appendicitis or for a boil or for an abscess on your gums. more and more rack rate is going to be charged to the uninsured. And the problem is just not the uninsured. The problem is the underinsured. More and more Americans who work at businesses who have had to struggle with the cost of insurance have hollowed out their insurance, i.e. more co-pays, i.e. more cost sharing. And those individuals are going to the hospital and they are going into debt that will not change. And hospitals will still be putting our poorest citizens into debt so that they can try to get a quarter on the dollar and hope to cut to break even. But they push a little towards Medicare. They push a little, very little towards Medicaid, but they push a lot towards private insurance. And this law does very little to affect that equation.
Well, earlier Dr. Quinn had talked about some of the strategies used to kind of limit the rising cost of health care. Let's go to the other side of the equation and talk about, you know, insurance premiums. Is there something – are there elements of the Affordable Care Act, maybe besides the medical loss ratio, that are trying – that attempt to stem the rising cost of insurance?
So there are, and Andrew is correct. There are a lot of pushes in that direction, but almost all of them are in Medicare. Because Medicare is our largest insurance program, and that is how the government can really kind of affect the cost side of the equation. But the fact is that there, for example, an MRI costs $1,000 in Japan. And when asked why it costs $1,000, the first response will be, we pay our workers less. And you say, that can't be it. And they say, second, we use American, old American technology. When we're done with an MRI machine here, we send it to Japan. And you say, well, that's part of it. The third answer is that the federal government sets a price for $1,000 for an MRI. And it is the government sets the price, and you work with that. This law does nothing to that sort. All of the people marching against this law and talking about Obamacare and get government out of my Medicare don't understand that the government isn't setting any prices. And until we begin to talk about what the cost of an IV bag is, what the cost of a procedure is, why is it as an MRI in New York, $4,000, and an MRI two places in St. Louis, $4,000 and $10,000. I mean, there is no actual bandwidth of cost. It's irrational. It does not follow logic. It does not follow the free market. So when we start talking about this law does not get to that side. And we are talking about the edges. We're talking about insurance and we're talking about quality, but we're not talking about the actual cost of care. And until we do, healthcare in our country will continue to be more expensive than any other westernized, industrialized country.
I think I just want to add into that. I think the basic problem is fee for service. And most countries don't have fee-for-service anymore. And as long as you get paid more to do more instead of getting paid more to do a better job, we all try to be altruistic and do the right thing, but it's really hard to avoid those incentives. The incentive in the American system is to do more, and we are incentivized to do more, and that's why our system is more per capita than any country on earth.
Okay, and we only have less than a minute left in the show today, but just briefly, if people want to get more information either from the patient side or the provider side, what would you recommend? Where could they go?
For the Affordable Care Act?
I mean, I feel like we just scratched the surface with this, but...
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of sites online.
Missouri Foundation.
You might know better than I do.
The Missouri Foundation. Go to mffh.org or covermissouri.org. And in fact, I've done 180 community meetings. You want someone like me to come to your house, come to your friends, your neighborhood, just give us a call.
Right. Thanks, and we'll have to end it there. Thanks to our guests, Thomas McAuliffe, Andrew Quint, and Mary Timmel. And thanks to our guests from the first half of the show, Michelle Baumstark and Greg. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online by going to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to stream video, submit questions and comments, and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all our last programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's show was produced by Lee Jianchong. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Eric Stasak. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. Thanks for joining us today and have a great week.